This is your weekly checkup with Howard Feldman and Dr. Anton Myberg, where medical innovation meets human understanding.
We live in a world that celebrates exhaustion. People brag about surviving on 4 hours of sleep as though it's some kind of an achievement. But what happens if sleep isn't laziness? And I'm talking to myself. What if sleep is as medically necessary as oxygen, water, and food? Tonight, on the weekly checkup, we ask some very uncomfortable questions. Are many of us slowly damaging our bodies and our brains simply because we aren't sleeping properly? I'm Howard Feldman. I'm sitting with Dr. Anton Myberg for the weekly checkup, and tonight we are speaking about sleep. I didn't want to have this conversation. You guys made me have this conversation because I know that I don't sleep enough. We need your questions, your thoughts, 061-895-1019. Dr. Anton Myberg, how are you doing?
Howard, nice to finally get on this topic with you because you are the penultimate sleeper. Let's get going.
I don't want to get going.
Take all your data. I think you can be my case study for the non-sleepers.
Yes, exactly. So if I said to you, I only sleep 4 to 5 hours a night, but I'm fine, medically, do you believe me?
Can I put a disclaimer in there when I answer that question?
Yes. What's the disclaimer?
The disclaimer is that we're still friends after this, okay?
Well, let's see. I'm already sure we're friends before.
So the truth is, I don't believe you, but I believe you because I've seen it in true living color. But a normal person surviving on 4 to 5 hours sleep a night is not really a good thing because it lands up causing a cognitive decline in people. In other words, they get impaired decision making. It affects their physical health, which is a real big thing, and I think I'll speak about that a bit later. And there's real long-term effects, and one of the major effects of that is what we call brain-term aging. So with sleep deprivation, your brain actually can fast-forward and age over 8 years going forward. So do I believe it? Yeah. Is it a good thing? No.
Okay, so let's start right at the beginning. What do we need sleep for?
So in one word, everything.
Okay.
But sleep is an active, vital, physiological process that we use as a metabolic as well as a neural and physical reset for our body. So it's kind of like a reset. We reboot our computers because when you're resting, your brain and your body almost execute critical maintenance in your body. And that's very important because these tasks are almost impossible to perform while you're awake. And what the brain does is it works on brain maintenance and cognitive functioning. So at nighttime, you've almost got a waste clearance type of system. And the brain's got a system called the glymphatic system. So we all know about the lymphatic.
Glymphatic.
Okay? Yeah, the lymphatic is for the blood vessels and to get the lymph. But the brain's got a glymphatic system.
Never heard the word.
And that works together with your cerebrospinal fluid to flush out metabolic waste from your brain.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the important things here is a disease like Alzheimer's because what the brain does is it gets rid of these toxic, and people will recognize this word, beta amyloid proteins, which is linked to neurodegenerative disease. So the sleep process is very important in that waste clearance type thing. Then it also works on a memory consolidation process. So your brain at time of sleep transfers your short-term memories from your day into a long-term storage compartment, almost like a librarian shelving your books. And then you get something called neuroplasticity, and that's a very big word. And that's basically where your sleep resets your connections between your brain neurons. It's called a synaptic reset. And that maintains your brain's ability to adapt, to learn new skills, and to solve complex problems. Over and above that, you need the sleep for physical repair and for growth. So for cellular regeneration, you need reduced metabolic demands whilst you're asleep in order to allow all your energy to shift towards what we call anabolism. And that's the building, repairing, and healing of muscle tissue in the brain and in the cells. And then, more importantly, hormone regulation. Because when you go into a deep sleep state, you trigger the release of vital hormones in your brain. And those hormones are things like growth hormone, testosterone, and these are all the hormones that are essential for vital tissue repair and recovery. And more important to me is things like immune maintenance, because your immune system releases cytokines and immune cells which fight off viruses, bacteria, and chronic inflammation. And then on a metabolic point of view, you get a whole systemic balancing. So from a cardiovascular point of view, from a metabolic point of view, you balance the hormones, and these are the important ones, the ghrelin and leptin. And we've spoken about those before. Mm. Those control the appetite.
That is interesting, because I do think that the less I sleep, the more prone I am to putting on weight. Yeah, maybe I'm looking for a sugar source, an energy source. Maybe these hormones are maybe out of balance. We need to take a very, very quick break just to go to ads. I'm Howard Feldman. We are talking about sleep and obviously the medical importance of sleep with Dr. Anton Meiberg. We'll be back just after this.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Welcome back to the Weekly Checkup with me and Dr. Anton Meiberg. We're talking sleep, and we were speaking about the body effectively doing maintenance during sleep. Is this, like, we hear about REM, REM, we hear about deep sleep. Is this all, is that all much of a muchness in terms of these medical benefits?
So we've just said that your key processes during sleep is that waste removal, that lymphatic system, mm-hmm. it's your memory consolidation and learning. And then, as you mentioned, active dreaming or REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep. So when the brain is asleep, it's actually not asleep, the body's asleep. But the body rests, the brain becomes highly active during this rapid eye movement sleep. Mm-hmm. And that we are quite accustomed to hearing people saying they get vivid dreams. There's quite a lot of emotional processing that happens, and there's improved cognitive function. So this rapid eye movement and deep sleep are two of your most vital stages of your sleep cycle. And they regulate how your brain and your body recover every night. So your deep sleep, and that's like stage four, that is where your sleep focuses on physical repair in your body.
Right.
And your REM sleep is where you prioritize your mental restoration. So your primary focus of your deep sleep, and that's your stage three, is physical recovery and tissue repair. It's a very slow, you get these what we call delta waves in the brain. Your heart slows down, your breathing slows down, your muscles are very relaxed, but they are capable of moving. And dreaming is very rare during this sort of stage, but you get like conceptual type of thing. We call it NREM, non-REM sleep, okay? And that generally dominates the first half of your sleep at night, where in opposition to your REM sleep, where that's a rapid eye movement sleep, that's a cognitive restoration and learning process of the brain. So your brain's highly active, and it almost mimics a wakeful type of state.
Interesting.
And that's why you hear people say, sometimes I feel like I've fallen off a building. Or like, you know, it's a very highly active thing. So you get an elevated, irregular heartbeat at the time. The muscles are almost temporarily paralyzed, like you can't move during that state. And the dream's frequent, vivid, intense, and that dominates the second part of the sleep cycle.
What is the ratio that is ideal between REM, REM, and deep sleep?
So if you're going to be having these vivid, intense dreams, then your deep sleep needs to be the majority of the time. You know, everyone needs an REM sleep.
Why? Because it's not restful.
Because you need to slow down your heart rate. You need to slow down your metabolism, okay, and still allow your brain to have that physical recovery. But at the same time, you still need cognitive repair. So you need both of them. Both of them are ideal, but your deep sleep is more important for repair. Remember, as I say, during this whole stage, your brain actually flushes out metabolic waste. Your brain's like a kidney in some senses. Even though we can't see it filtering out urine, you're flushing out all these proteins that you don't need. And it's
physical hearing. We've spent all day jamming ourselves with proteins, 100 grams per kilo. I mean, we've become protein mad, and now we say we've got to get rid of them.
There's certain proteins that aren't good for you. Okay,
fine.
And we know that we want our endocrine part of our body, the pituitary gland, we want that to release growth hormone to repair muscles and tissues. We need that immune boost. But on the other side, we need that REM sleep to help with emotional regulation, for memory consolidation. And I would say that probably the REM accounts for about 20% of our sleep, which is about 90 minutes of an average sleep night. Whereas the deep sleep, although we need more, in a healthy adult, we generally see that's only about 1 to 2 hours of the night.
You see, add that up, what have you got? 4 to 5 hours a night.
No,
even
one
less.
Plus one and a
okay,
half
fine,
is two
fine,
and a half.
Fine, 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 fine. I'm not a maths guy. You're the scientist.
Yes.
You're the scientist. So why do we need a dream?
Yeah, so yes. Okay, I mean, the question is, like, do we need a dream, or why do we dream? because what is the actual purpose of a dream? And if you ask anybody, they actually don't really understand the purpose of dreams. There's all these theories why dreaming happens, when it happens. It's when your brain waves are extremely active. It's almost as if you're awake. So the mechanism behind dreaming is that it acts as an overnight filing system in your brain. Remember, we spoke about the brain having a librarian. So your brain takes different experiences, it reviews them, it transfers data from short-term, from long-term, short-term, pushes it all around. And there's a hypothesis that they speak about that dreams, this hypothesis is very unfavorable and uncommon, but they say that dreams don't have an inherent meaning. Instead, it's your brainstem that sends these random electrical impulses to your cerebral cortex in your brain during the REM sleep. And your actual mind, your conscious mind, makes these random signals and memories into a cohesive story, and you make all of these things up when you wake up.
But actually at the time,
we don't believe in that.
Makes
okay?
No sense.
It doesn't make any sense. We feel that the dreaming is actually controlled by the amygdala. And the amygdala is your brain's emotional center. And this is highly active during REM sleep. And that allows your brain to process these difficult emotions, anxiety, traumatic events. And it acts almost like an overnight form of therapy. So the brain contracts and allows you for all these sort of abstract thoughts and memories. And it's almost like you have an unstructured yoga program in your brain at the same time. And then we go back to the old-fashioned, we call it a threat simulation theory. And psychologists think that dreams are actually a biological defense mechanism. And when you have a staged dream where something is realistic, it's actually a simplistic way to, like, for instance, you feel like you're being chased. That's your brain actually rehearsing its fight or flight mechanism to protect you and avoid threats in real life.
Interesting.
How interesting is that?
Very, very, very interesting. I love the idea that it's all these random things, but our conscious brain, our conscious mind makes sense of it.
Because, and makes decisions for us.
Yeah, no, because I'll tell you why. There's this idea that we sometimes, that if we're driving a car, we've got our conscious brain and our emotions. And sometimes our emotions, we find ourselves, I mean, the car is a metaphor, but we find ourselves at a spot and our emotions have taken us there. But what our conscious mind says, the reason that we're here is because of ABC. Actually, it's not. Our conscious mind rewrites the journey, but actually,
how many times do you drive to work and you don't even know how you got there? You actually got to work and think so.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's because I'm sleep deprived. Okay. So let's talk about teenagers. Why do they seem to sleep forever?
So much about everyone saying that teenagers are lazy, etc.
Well, they're not mutually exclusive.
They are because teenagers have a very different biological clock in a very different biological setting. So they undergo quite a natural biological shift, and it's called the sleep phase delay, and that's combined with their intense physical and neurological growth. So where to you and me it will look like laziness or like bad discipline, it's their body's own internal system that's clashing between a body clock in their stage of their life. So during puberty, their circadian rhythm, which is their rhythm to circulate their hormones in their brain and their body, shifts forward about 2 hours. So when you sleep, your brain releases something called melatonin, and that's a hormone that signals deep sleep in the body. But much later in the evening, in teenagers, it comes out about 11 o'clock at night, whereas in children it would be at 9 o'clock at night. So they almost get this night owl biology. So their melatonin peaks later. Therefore, they're naturally wired to stay awake for a later period of time. And they've got delayed morning. So the melatonin levels stay later, like elevated till late in the morning. Hence, they want to sleep later in the morning. So their brain is undergoing, and I'm talking about teenagers, they're undergoing this most rapid stage of cognitive maturation. They call it synaptic pruning of their brain, like when you prune flowers, you know. All the unused neural synaptic connections are being discarded in this waste management. They're learning throughout the day. They've got memory restructuring. And their brains work overtime to process new skills. So they require about 8 to 10 hours of sleep at night, but later at night because of all these shifts. Yeah. The problem we find with our teens these days is they get this chronic sleep debt. And that problem comes from the fact is that they go to bed late, and most schools, they at school by 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning, so they're forced to wake up during their deepest phase of their REM sleep. So they a deficit of about 2 to 3 hours of sleep during the week. And therefore, when it comes to weekend, in inverted commas, they just crash. And it's not because they crash, it's because their body is actually needing to, like, actually.
I've actually heard there are some schools in other parts of the world where they, high schools, that are starting later in order to deal with this.
For that reason.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
I'm Howard Feldman. This is The Weekly Checkup with me and Dr. Anton Meiberg. This evening, we're talking about sleep, the medical necessity of sleep. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back just after this.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Welcome back to The Weekly Checkup with me and Dr. Anton Meiberg. Send your questions through 061-895-1019. I'm not being rude by not answering them right now. This is a pre-record, so I will get to them. I'll take a look at them. I'll share them with Dr. Anton Meiberg, and we'll do what we can to get back to you with some of your answers. We were talking a little bit earlier about the minimum requirements, teenagers needing sleep. What about older people? Why do they? And I'm a bit worried about this because I've always been an early riser, like 5 a.m. and then now doing the morning show at 4 a.m., still not difficult for me. I'm worried about when I get older, I'm going to wake up before I go to sleep.
I mean, work that one out. Okay, I'd really like to see how you're going to work that one out. And God help your wife and every employee around you.
Figure that one out.
Everyone knows that older people just generally wake up earlier. Now, take that from your teenagers whose melatonin is released later on at night, with elderly people, people's natural shift is earlier. So they got an advanced sleep phase. So their internal body clocks, their circadian rhythm actually advances forward. So they get an earlier release of melatonin production in the evening. And therefore, they wake up earlier in the morning as well. And there's a few reasons for that. One of them, which is very, very interesting, is what we call an age-related visual change. So as a person gets older, the lenses in the eye, they either become yellow or foggy with age. And that filters out the light, which is we need light to keep our brain to signal to stay awake. So because the brain and the eyes receive less light in the evening, the brain thinks that the sun's actually setting earlier and it triggers sleep hormones prematurely.
That's so interesting.
Of course, older people spend less time in this deep restorative sleep pattern as well and more time in light to sleep stage during the day. And then there's also other things which we take into account, like medical factors, like a lot of elderly patients have physical discomfort, arthritis, or a greater need to use the bathroom, or sleep or disorders like apnea or restless leg syndromes. There's so many different things that can...
What is this restless leg syndrome?
So restless leg syndrome is basically when you're lying in bed and you feel like you can't keep your legs still. You just want to keep on moving them. And it's an inherent involuntary movement of your legs that just keeps you uncomfortable. It's like it's a painful...
And is that an age thing?
No, it's not an age thing, but with advancing age, it's more prevalent. Right. But it can happen in any age or any stage in your life.
Okay. Right. Let's talk about the human condition. Let's try and understand this. Are we sleeping less than we used to?
So, funny enough, the answer is going to be no. We've noticed that...
I did not think that was going to be the answer.
It actually hasn't significantly declined. If you look at all the statistics over the last few decades, it hasn't significantly declined for adults over the last few decades. However, adolescents, their sleep patterns have decreased. But the biggest issue here is not are we sleeping less, it's the quality of sleep that we're getting. And that's compromised by all our modern habits and environmental things. So
screens, scrolling,
people over the age of 50 have got much more stable sleep patterns and durations, where teenagers that need the sleep, their sleep patterns have declined dramatically. And it's definitely what we say. Factors like artificial temperature control, nighttime exposure to blue lights, stress, these all affect the quality versus the quantity of sleep.
Okay, so let's talk about those. Screen, blue light, scrolling, binge watching. Take me through all of those factors.
So they're all fundamentally actually connected to each other because your phone screens, and your phone screens generally have blue light, they disrupt sleep by delaying our body's internal body clocks. So that then inhibits the release of your sleep hormone melatonin. And you can say to me now, well, then why don't you take melatonin? It's not so simple. It doesn't just work by taking a tablet and you're going to go to sleep.
Right.
So when it delays our body clocks, it actually overstimulates your brain before bed. And that's the problem. So it then ends up shortening your actual sleep duration. It decreases your quality of sleep, and it contributes to insomnia and your morning grogginess. And that affects your hormones. Remember earlier I said it stops that pineal gland from secreting the melatonin, which you need, and you start to feel tired. You watch things like short-form videos that everyone watches on TikTok or Instagram, or that social media scrolling. What does that do? It triggers dopamine, and it triggers cortisol. So it actually puts your nervous system in the fight or flight active day mode, and you actually can't go to bed. And one of the biggest things is we get something called bedtime procrastination. So present company included, you have a busy day, and you feel yourself, well, I actually want to watch something on my phone because I'm punishing myself by not, and I've been busy the whole day, and I need time out. Except time out shouldn't be scrolling on a phone. Shouldn't be going into blue light. There's other ways to do it because all of these things interrupt our sleep architecture.
I know, but you know what? I walked into the house yesterday, effectively left the house at 5:30 a.m. and was home after 9:30. You know what? I deserve to be able to doom scroll. And then I got no sleep last night.
Well, that's the point. So when you're doom scrolling and when you've got the blue light, it stimulates your brain. So it delays your sleep cycle. And then you become engaged in what you're reading, and it distorts your time, especially doom scrolling, because I'm going to say mindlessly, because that's what we do. We mindlessly check social media, and we lose track of time. And then you become more alert because you've got this blue light, which is a shortwave blue light that stimulates your cognitive functioning, sparks your alertness, sparks your heart rate, and you aren't able to go back to sleep. So, you know, it takes a longer time for us to fall asleep. It builds up our anxiety. It disrupts our circadian rhythm. It suppresses your melatonin. All these things really, I think, and one of my biggest problems is what I call binge watching. Okay. You can start watching a series.
I don't want to disclose anything, but there's been some mornings where
well, I blame my wife because she loves watching TV.
Where Anton has said, you know what, we weren't so responsible. And you know, being not responsible at this age means watching too many series, episodes.
What's the problem with it? It actually causes a cognitive pre-sleep.
I know,
arousal.
But you know what? I think that if you don't binge watch at some point in your life, if you're not irresponsible, then you're just going to get old.
Okay, we can use it for many discussions and we can use it as a bad thing. But I'm saying
it's a good thing.
I'm not sure if it is because, you know, people who binge watch definitely have more insomnia. Mm. You know, you just one more episode and you've got that complex cliffhanger that you just have to wait and see.
Well, that's how they
to wait there, and that puts you on alert, pushes your heart rate up.
Of course.
And as I said, you get that revenge bedtime procrastination where you're actually like, well, I can't do
it. I love
that idea. And it disrupts your thing, makes you more groggy the next day. And you're actually sacrificing your rest to make up for your busy
sabotage.
Day.
There's no question.
It's proper sabotage.
Why do people wake up at 2 a.m.? And think about the most random aspects of life.
So,
and everybody has those.
It is so common and so normal. Mm. So a lot of people wake up 2 o'clock because they need to go to the bathroom. But people who don't need to go to the bathroom just wake up. And that's due to the fact that at 2 a.m. in the morning, you get a dip in your core body temperature. And then you release your stress hormones like cortisol. So the night's quiet. There's no external distractions. And then almost your brain goes into this complex default solving, problem solving mode, and you get amplification of your anxiety and unresolved life events. I mean, how many times have you woken up 2 o'clock in the morning thinking, oh, I've got to solve this, I've got to make a note on my phone? This cortisol spark that happens between 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning, it's a stress hormone. So then it lowers your melatonin at the same time. So if you're really stressed and then you get this fight or flight surge from your cortisol, it kind of jars you awake. So you
And then the sun rises eventually, and you think, what was I actually worrying about?
It's a problem. So, I mean, there's a negativity bias in the brain because you wake up in the dark, and then the logical, rational part of your brain, which we call the prefrontal cortex, is offline, and it's okay. But your amygdala, the emotional part, that fear-based center is very active. So those two are kind of going against each other. And then you worry more. You get this catastrophic idea that something's going to go wrong during the day. And there's a very simple way to fix that. Okay? Most of the sleep studies show that if you get out of bed and leave the room and go to another room and read a book for 15 to 20 minutes and then come back and get back into bed, that helps with that type of thing. That helps with that sleep disruption.
So I can tell you that I've always struggled with sleep, even as a kid. And there were nights that I would actually not even go to sleep just because I couldn't. And the one thing that I learned, even as a young person, is get out of bed, go to another room, read a book, and then come back, and then you stand more of a chance. Well, the one thing I never tried, but maybe I should have, is alcohol. Does alcohol help sleep or does it destroy sleep?
Well, okay. So when you were 12, you didn't try alcohol.
No,
I'm very happy to hear that.
You know,
is that because they didn't have, or they only
had
Black
Sugar's,
Label in those days?
They had Sugar's Regal.
They weren't brewing other things.
No, exactly.
No moonshine.
No.
So alcohol is commonly thought of as something that helps you fall asleep. But remember, alcohol is a sedative. So it may help you fall asleep quicker, but it actually destroys the quality of your rest. It disrupts those natural sleep cycles. It interferes with your deep sleep as well as your REM sleep, and it actually causes you to wake up in the middle of the night, which leaves you tired and unfocused the next day. So it can make you drowsy, but you know that it's a heavy sedation rather than the usual sleep that you get. It suppresses your REM sleep and it fragments your sleep. So the sedative effect of the alcohol actually wears off, and then you get that frequent awakening, you're tossing and turning in the middle of the night, as well as the fact the big issue with alcohol is you get breathing issues, because too much alcohol relaxes your throat muscles, which then can narrow your airway, and this makes you snore louder and can significantly worsen something like sleep apnea.
What about and I've always wondered this, the medication, sleeping tablets, sleeping pills, things like that. If you sleep with that kind of a medical aid, does that give you the same quality of sleep, or does it interfere with all of these natural processes?
So sleep tablets cause a quantity of sleep, not a quality of sleep.
Right.
Okay. You're basically taking processes in the body that are not natural, and you're helping settle down the body. So you don't get the same restorative sleep that you'd get with a normal circadian rhythm, but you do get a good quality of sleep because you're actually allowing your body to rest.
To have the time.
Yeah. Mm. But it's the problem comes where people start getting addicted to sleeping tablets. I mean, sleeping tablets on their own are very addictive, and certain sleeping tablets like benzodiazepines can affect your breathing cycle, can affect your respiration.
What is
tolerant.
The trade name?
Dormicum, for instance, is
okay.
A benzodiazepine.
Right.
You become tolerant. So you start off on 1 milligram, and then you need 2 milligrams.
It doesn't work
in you after a while.
Right.
And obviously that affects your respiration. It causes dependence. There's a whole lot of issues. Some people cannot sleep without a sleeping tablet. I get it. You know what I'm saying? There's ways to go through a process of understanding what's best for your body and work through it with your physician or your consulting doctor to help you understand what is best for you if that's an issue.
I'm not really interested in the answer to this next question, but I'm going to ask it anyway just because I know that it's responsible interviewing. What about caffeine after 4 p.m.?
So a small majority of people have no influence from caffeine. They don't get
a small majority, a small minority.
Well, I say majority because I think caffeine is very important. So I'm going to say a small majority, even though I don't think people who don't drink caffeine are relevant. Okay. That's why I say a small majority.
Okay, fine.
But generally, caffeine disrupts sleep, anything after 4 o'clock. And the reason is that caffeine's got a half-life of about 5 to 7 hours. So if you drink a coffee, let's say it's got 100 milligrams of caffeine. I'm using 100 milligrams because you brought it up earlier with your protein. Mm. Okay. By 5 hours later, at 9 o'clock, you will still have 50 milligrams of that caffeine in your system, which prevents the sleep. And it blocks something called adenosine in your body. So it blocks that chemical in your brain, which naturally builds up throughout the day to help you feel sleepy. So you're actually blocking that. It's a stimulant at the end of the day. And then it interrupts your sleep cycle because you're reducing your total time you need to sleep, and you delay how quickly you fall asleep without even realizing it. So most unhappy experts say you shouldn't have coffee, not after 2 o'clock in the day. But it's individualized. You know, as I say, some people can drink coffee later on the day. I can have a cup of coffee at 8 o'clock at night. It has no effect on me.
Yeah, I have to say that is generally my experience as well. 061-895-1019. What is the latest time that you have stayed awake for absolutely no good reason? Okay, well, maybe there was a good reason. And let me know the name of that series. I'm Howard Feldman. This is your weekly checkup with me and Dr. Anton Meiberg. We'll be back with you just after this.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Welcome back to the Weekly Checkup with me and Dr. Anton Myberg. When bad sleep becomes a medical issue. Right, let's move from simply being tired to genuine health risks with regard to sleep. What is insomnia medically?
So it's a sleep disorder at the end of the day, and it's characterized by a persistent difficulty to fall asleep. So staying asleep or waking too early, despite even having the opportunity to sleep, that's part of insomnia. And it leads to daytime distress and despair and fogginess and decreasing concentration and mood changes. And it's generally based according to two distinct patterns. Either it's based on the duration or it's based on the type of sleep disruption. So you can get an acute insomnia, which is a short term for a few days or a few weeks, or you get the chronic insomnia, and that's a long-term sleep issues. And then you get the type of sleep disruption, which is the onset. In other words, do you have trouble falling asleep at the beginning of the night, or is it a maintenance problem where you have trouble staying asleep, or is it a late insomnia where you actually wake up too early in the morning and you are unable to fall asleep again? And there are a lot of conditions that can add to this, such as high levels of stress, anxiety, depression, pain, even untreated asthma, sleep disorders like sleep apnea, restless leg syndrome, and certain medications, even cold medications that contain over-the-counter stimulants can cause you to stay awake. And then, of course, disruptive work for the minority of people, caffeine, and even using blue light electronic devices before bed. These things
could even impact you much later, in the earlier. Let's talk about sleep apnea. It's become a very big and important conversation. What is sleep apnea?
So sleep apnea is a process where whilst you're asleep, your body essentially stops breathing. There's two different parts to this called apnea and hypopnea. And this occurs when the muscles in the back of your throat relax too much during sleep, which causes your airways to collapse and become blocked. And that's essentially what we call obstructive sleep apnea. That's the one we all aware of. There's another one called central sleep apnea, which is that's when your brain fails to send a proper signal to the muscles for breathing. That's a neurological, neurodegenerative disease related. Okay. Now, the most common warning signs is loud chronic snoring, which is can be punctuated by gasping or choking sounds in the middle of the night, or even together with that, waking up with a very dry mouth or a headache in the morning, and more importantly, severe daytime fatigue, excessive sleepiness during the day, poor concentration, irritability, and brain fog. And the reason why it's so important to understand this is because if you don't treat this, it lands up causing long-term consequences to the body. So you get chronic oxygen deprivation in the body. It interrupts your sleep. It can cause what we call chronic dilatation of the heart, enlargement of the heart. It can cause breathing difficulties. Almost if you look at your heart and your lungs like a pool filter, it causes a clogging up of the fluids going from the heart to the lungs. It increases your risk of high blood pressure, heart disease, stroke, diabetes. So it's worked out by means of understanding how many episodes of apnea you have during the night and how to treat it effectively.
What does that mean, how many episodes of apnea? What's normal?
Okay, so first of all, I think the most important thing of that is to note that if you've got sleep apnea, essentially you don't know it. Your body wakes itself up during the night when you're in a deep state of sleep, but you yourself don't know. Your body actually compensates for it. You stay asleep, but it re-triggers itself. So you stop breathing. Now, generally, someone who's got sleep apnea, we say it's got over 8 episodes of either apnea, where they completely stop breathing, or they hold their breath for a few seconds, hypoapnea. If you have 8 episodes of that per few minutes, okay, you consider it as having sleep apnea, okay? So in 1 hour, you can have multiple episodes where you hold your breath at times for 60 seconds to 90 seconds. Now, if I asked you now to hold your breath to 60 seconds, you'd pass out.
Yes.
But whilst you're asleep, you hold your breath, and then your body mechanism, it's got that fight and flight thing. It wakes you up. So it fragments your sleep.
So you don't know
you've been woken up. In other words, when it wakes you up, it takes that rapid eye movement sleep or takes that deep sleep and it takes you out of that phase.
And then you've got to start that process again.
It causes
strain.
You
could be doing this all night.
Yeah. And that it causes an oxygen deprivation. So it puts your body into that complete fight or flight mode. You get massive strain on your heart, your brain, and your overall health. And It causes metabolic issues. It causes systemic complications. It's a big thing. And I always say to my patients when they come to me, do you snore? They say, I don't know. Ask my wife. Okay, does he snore? Yes, he snores a lot. I say to them, watch your husband or watch your partner, because men and women, see if they stop breathing in the middle of the night. And it's not to make you paranoid and sit there and study your husband or wife during the night and see, but
because that's creepy.
You would know if they're snoring loudly without the help of alcohol, if they're overweight, if they
but
it's
so snoring
things.
Is an indicator, but actually it's not the snoring itself, it's the
snoring
stopping.
Is an indicator, but it's not a diagnostic tool,
right?
Because you can have a congested nasal passages,
yes,
you can
right.
have large in children large adenoids, you know, these type of things don't mean you've got sleep apnea, you've got something obstructing your airways. But generally in people over the age of 40 who've got snoring and they're complaining of this fogginess in the morning,
so,
the headaches.
Percentage wise, do you think that you know, how many people are walking around with sleep apnea?
So I was listening to a podcast the other day, and they've estimated that 80% of people with sleep apnea at the moment don't realize they've got sleep apnea. So they reckon over 200, 300 million people throughout the world are walking around with undiagnosed sleep apnea.
And that's got real consequences.
Real consequences, because people can fall asleep while driving their car.
There's that. Yeah. There's heart attack, stroke,
yeah. And
weight
as I
gain.
Said, it affects both sexes. Everything. Not only overweight older men. You don't have to be overweight. But generally, people who are overweight, one of the treatment modalities is to lose weight to help with that.
Yeah, that is so interesting. And the connection between testosterone, libido and sleep?
So your poor sleep quality does affect your testosterone levels and your libido, because majority of your daily testosterone production occurs during sleep. And that's why if you're testing someone's testosterone, generally you go for an early morning sample to get a real sensitive reply, because it's all created through the night.
Right,
okay,
right.
So you get a hormonal imbalance with fatigue. There's no doubt about it. And this hormonal imbalance can actually crush your sex drive. It can make you tired. It can cause fatigue. And they've noticed that restricting your sleep to 5 hours of sleep a night can decrease your testosterone levels by up to 15% in healthy people.
Sure.
And there's something they call the sweet spot rule.
Mm-hmm.
So that you need 7 to 9 hours of quality sleep per night to get optimal testosterone levels in the body. However, getting too much sleep, like over 10 hours, can also negatively impact your testosterone production. It also affects things like cortisol, and it's a vicious cycle, because low testosterone levels will cause insomnia and poor quality of sleep, and poor quality of sleep will cause insomnia and low testosterone levels. So, it's a
very, very, very fine balance. Can we just talk about before we go to a break, just in terms of the availability, CPAP machines. I see people have these little nose strips. I see they have. What are the options?
So, I think that the first thing to say is that in order to treat CPAP, now the CPAP machine is the most standard gold standard treatment. The CPAP machine is what we call continuous positive airway pressure machine. That is the gold standard device for treating it.
What
and
does
as
that
I said,
do?
So. We look at the apnea hypopnea index, the number of times you breathe per hour. And what that machine does is delivers a continuous stream of pressurized room air into an air tube through a mask. And that acts as what we call a splint to keep your upper airways from collapsing. And there's newer machines that's called auto CPAPs or BiPAP machines. And that continuously modulates the pressure in your airways to
needed.
Keep your airways open at the time. Now, interesting enough, you spoke about mouth devices and all that type of thing. So mouth devices are generally there for people who can't tolerate the CPAP machine, but with mild sleep apnea. And that even a specialized dentist can make for you to help you with that. Okay, But there are pros and cons to that, because albeit that the mouth device doesn't need electricity, you know, if you're using it for a long period of time, it can cause TMJ problems. It can cause tooth thinness or shifting of your bite. The root cause in a majority of people is weight loss. You know, just dropping your weight by 10% can reduce sleep apnea levels by up to 50% in people. And there's other things that which is groundbreaking at the moment, pharmaceutical accelerators like your GLP-1 receptors. GLP-1 receptors and agonists like your tirzepatide, semaglutide, your retatrutide, they've shifted sleep medicine because by altering people's weight, altering the inflammatory response in the body,
it's decreasing
that systemic fat reduction, and it's caused a reduction in sleep apnea.
Did I read somewhere that they might be trialing medication for sleep apnea?
They are trialing medication, but the medication we speak about now, the GLP
yes, no,
ones,
that's a different.
The other ones, I'm not so sure. I think they're going to stay in trials for a while.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, we're running out of time, which really, really does bother me. Can I just shoot some questions at you before we go to a break in terms of this? Does bad sleep increase heart attack risk?
Yes.
Is there a link to strokes?
Yes.
Does poor sleep increase diabetes risk?
Definitely.
Okay, why do tired people crave junk food?
Because their brain chemistry and their hormones trick them into seeking instant energy. So your brain's reward centers go into this overdrive type of thing, and your hormones tell you that you need this high-calorie, sugary snack, and you get an increase in that ghrelin, that hunger hormone that we spoke about,
mm-hmm.
and your leptin, which is the one that stops your food, is also decreased, so you feel hungry and you don't feel satisfied, and it's almost like your brain's reward system is hijacked at the same time.
Is sleep connected to dementia risk?
Most definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Major increases your risk of cognitive decline.
Okay. And finally, before we go to a break, can chronic exhaustion age people physically?
Yes.
Great. I'm Howard Feldman. This is your weekly checkup with me and Dr. Anton Meiberg. We'll be back just after this. And then I want to talk to him about how to actually sleep better. It's all very well to have all of this information. What do we do with it?
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Welcome back to the final segment of this evening's weekly checkup with me and Dr. Anton Meiberg. We're speaking about sleep. Send your questions, your comments, your thoughts, 061-895-1019. A reminder, this is a pre-record. We, in fact, recorded this earlier in the day today, but I will be checking the messages and do what we can to come back to people. Right, I would want to move on to practical advice. I hate the expression, sleep hygiene, but it's become a very, very commonly used phrase. What is it?
So this is almost like become a behavioral habit for people.
Mm.
So it's a way of taking environmental practice to promote consistent, uninterrupted, and high quality of sleep. In other words, practicing good sleep hygiene will train your body to expect rest and reinforce that natural circadian rhythm with the internal clock in your body. And in order to do that, you need to maintain a strict sleep schedule. Very easy, I'm sure, for everybody.
Yes.
But
why didn't you just say
you
so?
You need to be consistent. Wake up and go to bed same time every day, even on weekends, which is completely impossible. Okay. Heighten your sleep drive. So if you have a bad night of sleep, and then you got to resist that urge to sleep in, because waking up at the normal time that you would normally wake up ensures that you'll be actually more tired to sleep better the next night. And then limit daytime napping. So we know that daytime naps are important.
I wanted to ask you about daytime napping.
And not longer than 20 to 30 minutes during the day, okay? And don't nap later on in the afternoon, because that will fragment your sleep. And also, you've got to establish a wind-down routine when you go to bed. So unplug from screens at least 30 to 60 minutes before you go to bed. Stay away from that blue light. Lower the lights in your room. Engage in calming rituals. And make sure that if you can't fall asleep after 20 minutes, get out of bed, go read, come back.
I mean, is reading a good option?
Reading's a very good option, because your mind then focuses on a different function. So your focus, and especially not even a Kindle because it's got light, rather take a normal book. Your mind focusing on turning the pages, on conceptualizing what you're actually reading, and that focus of moving your eyes around between the pages makes your brain tired. So it's very, very important. And we're seeing that, like, part of the sleep hygiene is being hacked now, all these sleep trackers. Okay?
Yes, yes, yes. I've got that in one of my rapid fire question rounds. But talk to me about Whoop.
Something like Whoop, okay?
And my watch, which I'm meant to sleep with, to tell me how well I slept. But I kind of know when I wake up how well I've slept.
So they're actually quite reliable.
Uh-huh.
And they look at your basic trends.
Mm.
They aren't reliable for sleep staging. In other words, like, it doesn't tell you when you're in a proper deep or REM sleep compared to actual clinical testing. But they do provide, like, valuable clinical data. The problem is their psychological impact is mixed up. Okay, so some people find them motivating, and other people actually get anxious from using them.
Yeah.
And there's a big science behind them because you look at heart rate and you look at heart rate variability. And heart rate variability during sleep is very important because it helps understand what your resting heart rate is and what happens from minute to minute to sleep of your heart rate. So they can be positive, they can be negative. We know that the positivity comes from the fact that they actually help you spot patterns between your daily habits. In other words, have you had alcohol the night before, caffeine the day before, your workout is, and it shows you how well you recover. And then some people are motivated by them. The negative side is something called orthorexia. And that's not anorexia, it's orthorexia.
I just want to know if I'm suffering from it. What is it?
So that's sleep anxiety. It's like orthosomnia. That occurs when you obsess over your tracker data and causes stress and poor sleep.
Right.
And there's an inaccuracy to some of these things because you could feel great the next morning, you have a restful night, but your tracker will say, but you slept badly. So then it actually causes you to simply feel tired because of that. So you've got to use these type of trackers in a very structured pathway and a way to understand that using them doesn't define your sleep. Using them, you must use them to benefit your sleep.
Does it matter when you exercise?
Definitely. There's no doubt that the later you exercise, the more chance of your body being in a heightened state of focus and irritability because you've pushed up your heart rate. You need time for your body to settle down. And, I mean, it's generally thought of that early afternoon or early morning, much better because then you won't release all of those stimulating hormones. And we know that exercise will increase your core body temperature. And actually what happens in the night, your core body temperature decreases, which is what you want. And that helps you get into that deeper sleep much better. So any strenuous or high-intensity workout, you shouldn't do at least 2 to 4 hours before bed.
Wow.
You know, some exercises you can do moderately, and that will help you fall asleep because it temporarily raises your body temperature. But then as your core temperature drops afterwards, it allows it to go there in a quicker state.
Okay, so now I've got a few rapid-fire questions, some of which you've answered, so I'm just going to ignore those, but I just want to go through it. The best sleep position.
There's no best sleep position. The best sleep position is what's good for you. So some people use sleep position for spinal problems. In other words, back sleeping is the gold standard for spinal issues. Side sleeping is the most popular for people who snore and who've got acid reflux. And the least of them is the stomach sleeping. That's considered the least recommended because, you know, if you've got back pain, it flattens your spine's natural curvature. So there's no
sleep
real
are you comfortable. Okay, we've spoken about sleep aids like Whoop. What about mouth taping?
Oh, I love that one.
You like mouth taping?
No, I hate it. Oh. I love the topic, okay? So it's actually nonsense and can be dangerous. There's no doubt about it. So you'll go into social media and they'll say, put on the mouth tape because it cures snoring and reshapes your jawline. You know, there's scientific evidence. There's not. All the evidence is lacking. What the problem with mouth taping is it can actually block your airway. So if you've got undiagnosed sleep apnea or you've got severe nasal congestion due to allergies or a deviated septum, taping your mouth can actually restrict your oxygen intake. It can cause suffocation. It can cause panic. And it can mask symptoms like merely taping it. It blocks the symptoms of a blocked nose or disordered breathing without fixing it.
Yeah.
So people advocate for it because they say that it forces nasal breathing, which then will filter the air and reduce dry mouth. But we know that people naturally open their mouths at night because they can't get enough air through their noses.
Enough oxygen.
So if you force your mouth shut, then it doesn't cure the obstruction. It just prevents you from getting necessary oxygen there. And it's far safer
just sleep in a plastic bag.
To use a nasal strip. Because the nasal strips.
So are these nasal strips good?
Yes. They're what we call external dilators. So they actually open up and gently pull your open nasal passages. And that dramatically can improve your nasal airflow.
That's interesting. Magnesium.
Love magnesium. So magnesium, and the one I use is magnesium glycinate for myself personally. It helps with anxiety, it helps with stress, and helps with sleep patterns.
And you take it at night?
Take it at night time before you go to bed.
Right. Okay. Weighted blankets.
Weighted blankets are so interesting. Weighted blankets are the best thing ever because they're like when you're a child, you know, when you're a baby, you get swaddled, you know, in the bed. So they work by a mechanism of deep pressure stimulation. So it's a gentle, even pressure that actually mimics a firm hug. And that sensation promotes relaxation in the body.
That's so interesting.
It helps ease your racing mind, encourages your body to produce more melatonin. So especially for people with anxiety and insomnia, it works, and people with sensory processing needs, it works unbelievably. Kids with ADHD, adults with ADHD, they find that that weight grounds and calms them.
That's so interesting. I even used it on Gatsby, our Swiss Shepherd, when he was scared of lightning, and it actually worked. 8 hours we know about, why people wake up at 2 a.m. We know about pets, talking about Gatsby, pets in the bed.
So pets in your bed can ruin your sleep. You get what we call micro awakenings.
Mm-hmm.
So especially with like cats or loud sleeping dogs, they move around throughout the night. They can mm-hmm. bump you. They affect your sleep. Then there's things like allergies, there's asthma,
right.
There's temperature regulation I've spoken about. Pets radiate body heat, which then can cause you to overheat. And then, of course, there's hygiene concerns. I mean, the mattress, you've got it increases dirt, ticks, fleas. There is an upside to it.
That's not Gatsby.
There is an upside because there's an upside of bonding and comfort.
Yes.
But last I checked, if you've got a partner, that should help with that.
Right.
You know, and the white noise of a purring pet can also be soothing, but so can that of an air conditioner.
And that is all we have time for. A fascinating conversation. Actually wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. It was even quite interesting. This was the Weekly Checkup with me and Dr. Anton Marburg. Tonight we spoke about the importance of sleep. Next week we're talking allergies. So just make sure that you are listening. Have a fantastic evening. I'll be back on the Morning Mayhem, 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. tomorrow morning. I'll see you then. Don't be late.